Hi, and welcome to Kiskaji, where we explore women-identified, gender-nonconforming, and gender-expansive communities across the Americas, and how we are creating a post-pandemic future grounded in justice, abundance, and hope, and how you can be part of it. I am Bia Vieira, inviting you to join us in this journey and in action. I'm very excited to be here today with Crystal Echohawk. Crystal is not only a visionary leader, but also an amazing human being. She's the founder and executive director of Illuminative, which is the first national Native-led nonprofit that's really committed to amplifying contemporary Native voices. We met because of the Culture Surge Project. And I want to give you an opportunity to talk to us about Illuminative and your journey, your personal journey, your professional journey to get to Illuminative.
Thank you so much, Bia. It's so good to be here with you. And again, you and the Culture Change Fund and the California Women's Foundation have been just such important investors in our work. And we're so grateful to be here, to be able to, share something about Illuminative. I think in terms of my personal journey and a little bit about me, I'm a citizen of the Pawnee Nation in Oklahoma. That's where our tribe is located, just outside of Stillwater, Oklahoma. And I'm a member of the Kitkahaki band within our people. And, in terms of my journey, I have worked and served in Indian country my entire life. And I think just really raised in a family almost everyone in my family in some shape or form works for our people, and whether it's our Pawnee people or just Indian country at large. And so I think we were really raised with, and instilled with values around service, right? Mm-hmm. And the importance of really fighting for tribal sovereignty ever since I was little. So I think that's one important part of the journey. I mean, I think, on two parallel tracks. One, as I mentioned, I've worked for an Indian country my whole life, whether it's for my tribe or working for different national Native nonprofits until I started my own Illuminative, and really fighting, for the rights of Native peoples, particularly really focused on Native American youth and families, and increasingly really focused on power of Native women, which is so inspiring. But I think, as moving through my career, I've often only been the only Native American in the room, and just was consistently frustrated over years, whether it's, looking at data in which our people are never included, rarely or ever included, and working within philanthropy and understanding that erasure, right, in the way that we're left out and with philanthropy being so data driven was just devastating for our people. To really constantly understanding, watching how we're just really reduced often to caricatures and people don't really take our issues very seriously. And I think so many conversations mm-hmm. in this country, when it particularly becomes to race, are often only framed in black and white. Right. And that, and we're not the only ones that are erased out of that conversation. Right. But just really feeling that very deeply. And I think, with so many different colleagues and tribal leaders and just grassroots organizers, just this constant frustration around our erasure. And then, on a very deeply personal level, as a single mom, raising a beautiful daughter, who we gave a traditional Dakota name to. Her dad is Dakota and Pawnee, but, she was really relentlessly bullied when she was in middle school, and watching the pain of that, and the fact that her teachers wouldn't even call her name on the roll, in classes because they didn't want to bother to try to pronounce her name, or kids, verbally and physically abusing her. And when I went to go seek help from the principal of the school, I'll never forget being told that it was my fault that her father and I had given her a traditional name and that, we should have given her an English one.
Wow. Oh, my goodness. I am so sorry that happened to your daughter, that also you had to experience that. That is such painful experiences on top of, generations of painful experiences.
Yeah. Well, but I think the pain in watching that, and I'm not unique. I mean, Native American children and parents and families go through this every day, and a far worse But that moment when the principal said that, my daughter made the decision afterwards that she no longer wanted to use her traditional name. So she wanted to be called Star. Mm-hmm. And that was deeply painful. And that, you know, she also really struggled with thoughts of suicide and severe depression. And even when I went to try to go get services and mental health assessments and all of those things, I'll never forget sitting there in intake and the woman read my name out loud and then just said, well, you must be unemployed. You must not have health insurance. And it was automatically this bias that was triggered because of my name or, you know, how many times people asked me if I was an alcoholic. If I beat my child, if my child was homeless, I mean, just, you know, not knowing anything about our story, but understanding that there was this automatic, not only implicit bias, but explicit bias that was just triggered by this, you know, just our name alone, our tribal affiliation. So those two things, the personal and the professional and the political really came together to say it's enough is enough. And in 2016, I founded and co-led a project called the Reclaiming Native Truth Project, which was the largest public opinion project ever done, to really explore what are the dominant narratives and perceptions that the American public have about Native peoples and key institutions like Congress and the courts and media. Where do those perceptions come from? And how do they affect not only the way that people think about us, but the way that we're treated? And so really with the findings of that research, it was really profound. And it also really it shed a light on the way forward about how we could really begin to change the way that people think about and engage with Native peoples. And that's when I founded Illuminative in 2018.
Wow. Crystal, I'm curious about that the strategy that you chose was an opinion poll. Can you talk a little bit about why? Like, what was the idea there in terms of what is the power of narrative and why start there?
Yeah, I think, you know, it was a number of things. And I really credit just this amazing group of colleagues around us, right? Like, because we didn't know, I'm not a researcher, right? I'm an organizer, I'm an advocate. But I think, you know, I'll never forget, it was a few things. I remember that when this really epiphany about we need to do something happened in 2015, it was when the summer when the Supreme Court, right, handed down the decision on marriage equality. And remember just this beautiful moment of just cities all across the country lit up in rainbow colors and people were so celebrating. And I remember thinking this is so profound and to think about the cultural shift that had happened in the country that led to the highest level of policy change. How did that happen? And really thinking about that and talking with people and thinking, you know, that didn't happen on its own,
absolutely,
right? There was intention, right? And strategy about really moving public support and education. And I was just so inspired, like, wow, imagine if we could somehow in a parallel way do that for Native people, right? So that was really a big ingredient. And then my kind of co-conspirator was my dear friend, Alvin Warren, who at the time worked at the Kellogg Foundation, and he's from Santa Clara Pueblo. And he's like, you know, Crystal, we need data. We really need data because people can't see us. And that needs to be our weapon. It's got to be data. And then some other colleagues, actually, it was really odd at the American Heart Association, who had been doing a lot of work around doing a lot of focus groups, public opinion polling to really look at how they could drive policy change around public health. And I think all these wonderful people around me sort of helped me put all the ingredients in the mix, right, about how we really needed, you know, not just the public opinion polling, we did focus groups, right? We did social listening over 6 months, and it actually happened during Standing Rock. It was a fascinating time to dial into the national conversation as Native Americans during the stand at Standing Rock. To interviewing members of Congress and federal judges and law clerks. I mean, leaders in media and philanthropy and social justice. I mean, it was a very diverse set of methodologies we used to kind of get all these inputs to really map what people think about us and where that comes from.
Crystal, that is such a powerful, powerful tool that you really developed. And can you share a little bit about what you learned from the research?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think our biggest finding was that invisibility is one of the greatest threats we face as Native peoples. And that's a big statement, you know, given some of the challenges that our community faces. But what we really found is that, you know, nearly 80% of Americans know little to nothing about Native peoples. And 72% rarely or never encounter any information about us. And as we really began to kind of explore and unpack and through our research and existing research that had done by, you know, amazing scholars, like, for example, Dr. Sarah Shears, she found that nearly 80% of schools in the country, for example, don't teach about Native Americans past 1900. So what that means is literally generation after generation of Americans are conditioned to think that we no longer exist, because sort of the last thing they learn about us is pre-1900, probably Wounded Knee. And then we fade to black. Right. And there's no other education, you know. So, for example, every American, probably high school student, is still required to take a government class. They don't understand that tribes are sovereign governments and that we have a nation-to-nation relationship with the federal government, that there's a federal trust responsibility that we are recognized within the Constitution, and that there's an entire body of federal Indian law that supports tribal sovereignty. So that was big. And then I think also based on the research that Dr. Stephanie Freiberg and her colleagues did, they found that our representation in TV and film hovers between 0 to 0.4%. And they also found that when you Google Native American, you know, as a search term, 95% of those images that would come up were pre-1900 and they were of men.
Right.
That's astounding. Like when you look at that level of erasure and you think about something in Google and the amount of data and content it pulls in, that's what comes up. And so that literally what we found, you know, as we looked across sectors of society, in that, but it was big systems that were perpetuating and institutionalizing our erasure as Native peoples. And I think for Native Americans, when we came across this data and we saw it, it helped us so much. It was so empowering because we constantly walk through life feeling that invisibility, but we constantly think it's our own individual circumstances and situations, but understanding that it's about big systems, I think, was so empowering for so many of us that we now, because we could see a way forward, right? And how that we needed to disrupt and interrupt that invisibility. But we also found through our work with Dr. Freiberg that what invisibility does is it serves to dehumanize, right? It dehumanizes. When somebody can't see you, they can't empathize with you. They don't understand you, and you don't exist, you know? And so really she helped us to understand that invisibility is the modern form of racism against Native peoples, and that it needs to be an urgent priority for us to completely dismantle that invisibility and fight for our visibility as contemporary Native peoples, and that we really needed to center contemporary Native voices and stories and issues in order to really, you know, fight against racism, to fight against all of those, you know, the systematic discrimination that we faced. I think the other big finding is that on the flip side of invisibility is that the small bits of representation that do eke through, in particularly in TV and film and other places and media, is 9 times out of 10, it's pre-1900. Or it's rooted in these very problematic tropes that were nothing more than alcoholics, that were just, you know, sort of mired in poverty and dysfunction, that the majority of representations of Native women are these over-sexualized representations, or, you know, often, more often than not, we're being assaulted in a story, right? And that our women don't even typically make it to the end of the story, right? And so right. We were seeing that, or racist sports mascots, you know, within professional sports, you know, collegiate and K-12, that's actually one of the only ways that most Americans associate with Native American culture and identity is to watch a bunch of non-natives in red face with crazy fake headdresses and all kinds of stuff. We were understanding that that was the only thing that people were seeing. And that in itself, right, through the research that Dr. Freiberg and others had done, found that what that does is not only increase depression and anxiety and suicidal ideation within our youth, right, but it also fuels bias and racism against our people. So it crystallized all of this for us to really begin to understand from a standpoint of organizing and strategy that we need to have a systems approach, right, to this, and that we really needed to work hard to, you know, disrupt and interrupt invisibility and smash toxic stereotypes and false narratives about us in order to really advance our work to build power for our people, to advance equity and justice. We have to really take this issue around representation on in order to ensure that we're really making, you know, progress on all the issues of critical importance to us.
Wow.
Thank you so much. I mean, the power of narrative change and culture change in combination with advocacy and, you know, policy change, taking on system is really incredible. And I know that you, an Illuminative among many others, I mean, you mentioned the mascots. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the work that you did, the incredible work that you did to really push for name change and what has happened.
Well, definitely. I mean, you know, I have to say, you know, as most people hopefully know, in 2020, huge victory for Native peoples, right? With the Washington football team finally dropping its racist, you know, dictionary defined racial slur that was their team name, right? And so, but that fight had been going on for more than 3 decades. And I think that's the important thing I have to say, because I think a lot of people thought that that was something that was about 2020 and our reckoning with systemic racism. No, that battle was seeded and fought for decades by, you know, thousands of Native American activists, but just really, you know, important Native leaders like Suzanne Harjo, who really is sort of one of the grandmothers of the movement against mascots. Mm-hmm. And Amanda Blackhorse, just, you know, also an amazing, amazing, fierce advocate. You know, in terms of our role, again, our research found, right, that mascots are really detrimental. As I mentioned, they fuel bias and discrimination against our people, hate speech. It's really, you know, has psychological consequences on our youth. So we knew this was an important issue we needed to tackle. But it's a hard issue. Americans were really, you know, when we did our polling, were really stuck in this notion of, no, mascots honor you. You know, that yes. Somehow Native people don't know our own experiences in our own mind. We have to constantly be told by non-Native people, like, you don't know, we're honoring you. And we're like, no, you're not. Wow. So this was a tough, tough issue, right? And so we used really, again, one of our biggest weapons in our narrative culture change work is data. Right, in science, and really working with amazing scientists that were showing the harm that these things caused. But I think, you know, what happened with Washington would have never happened, unfortunately, without, you know, the murder of George Floyd. That changed everything. And, you know, and when that happened, and just all of a sudden the groundswell, this outrage and reckoning, the start of a reckoning finally with systemic racism, you know, began to happen. And then suddenly, you know, we started to see the wave of, you know, brands like Aunt Jemima and others right. saying, okay, we're going to take that down. And all of a sudden we started seeing that everyone was saying racialized brands need to stop. And it was like, we suddenly saw the opening. And then really, I'll never forget, it was on, a lot of people remember, it was a controversial day. It was Blackout Tuesday, right? Where a lot of people were posting the black squares and making statements. And the Washington football team said, you know, we stand against systemic racism. And I'll never forget, AOC and Congresswoman Deb Haaland both tweeted, you know, calling this hypocrisy out. And that if you're really against racism, change your name.
Change your name.
And that launched the first wave of social groundswell. And then what we did is we really jumped in and we worked with artists. And because of COVID, we have, you know, we really leaned into digital organizing on social media. And we really managed to begin to organize the groundswell of people just hammering away on the team. And then we started really going after their sponsors and big companies like Nike and Bank of America and FedEx, right? And really looking at how we could really generate public pressure against the kind of the financial ecosystem supporting this racist name. And then we fortunately were able to link up with the investors. There was about investors organized that represented about $62 billion worth of investments. That was actually led by a Native woman. She's Mandan Hidatsa. Her name is Carla Fredericks, and she was the head of First Peoples Worldwide. We joined forces with them, and between that social groundswell and the investors' pressure, that is what helped to tip it. So, you know, but again, there were thousands of people that were part of that, and Illuminative was just, we're really happy that we were able to kind of be a part of this really significant victory for our people. Yeah.
Wow. And it sounds like, you know, when you say you were ready to take advantage of this moment, because it is, you know, difficult to coordinate with artists and movement builders. So can you talk a little bit about how is it that you were ready? What did you have in place? What did it take to have this in place to be able to take advantage of this moment?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the biggest things is that, you know, we had already been working on the research, right? I mean, we had the research, we had sort of the talking points. We had actually, it was interesting, we had planned to launch a mascot campaign in early 2020 and had to scramble it in February once we understood the gravity of the pandemic, right? So we sort of had already had, luckily we had already had some things in development with our researchers and with some artists we had been working with. But I think, you know, more and more as you know, I think about social justice, you know, folks and advocates, you know, we live in a 24/7 media environment, right? And I think what we have learned quickly over time, and I think 2020 really taught us, is the power of rapid response. And the more that you can build your capacity and ability to really understand those opportune moments when you can really jump in, when something is unfolding, and to really work, not only just, it's not just only about sort of working and posting on social media, but I think also we've done such intentional organizing with non-Native allies, right? Core partners, you know, like our sisters in Culture Surge, right? And sort of the broad network of so many different social justice organizations and people working in the field of narrative and culture change, you know, in relationships we've built with influencers and other people that we were able to kind of organize across a broad ecosystem, right? With kind of, you know, using art and graphics and sort of, and coupled with data that we really are able to kind of translate and make that very accessible. The educational components, because we knew we had to educate Americans on this issue. All those ingredients came together. But I think that that sort of characterizes, I think, in so many ways, our work. That's such a key element of organizing these days is the ability for rapid response. In 2020, boy, we just learned through the fires of 2020 about needing to just, you know, really be poised and ready to go at any given moment. And we learned a lot. And luckily, we achieved a lot, too.
Absolutely. Can you talk a little bit about the work, you know, the amazing work that you did in collaboration with others, but Illuminative really took the lead during the presidential election of 2020, and of course, dealing also with the impacts of COVID?
Yeah. You know, I think a few things, you know, what started when COVID, when we really just suddenly all embraced as a country. You know, I'll never forget a year ago, I've just spent so much time reflecting on that feeling of just, oh my gosh, wow, this is stuff of movies, you know, and understanding how bad it was, and getting early reports, you know, about how, you know, there was less than a, you know, 100 ventilators all across the Indian country healthcare system, right? Less than 100 ventilators and hospital beds, and we had no access to PPE or testing. And remembering in the early days of the first CARES Act that we weren't even included. And it really began to understand that invisibility is a matter of life or death, right? And that our need to really amplify stories, not only about COVID's impact, but how we were addressing it. And a lot of people don't know, tribes took an early leadership role in shutting down their borders, right? On going on lockdown, doing those types of measures. People only wanted to talk about, you know, Navajo in the sense of like, let's talk about them not having running water. Let's talk about how poor and pitiful they are. What they missed was the absolute brilliance of grassroots organizers at Navajo when the federal government failed in its federal trust responsibility to show up and provide the necessary assistance. Grassroots community members self-organized. They raised money. They got water and PPE and everything they needed for the people. And across Indian country, we organized to get resources and assistance to protect our communities. So we knew just as 2020, we knew that we had to really organize hard to ensure that visibility for our people. And so as we came into the election cycle, you know, the dominant narrative about Native peoples is that our vote doesn't really matter, that we're a small, insignificant population. And I think even within the progressive movement, most people in the progressive movement actually ignore the Native vote, you know, and that hurts, right? When you're talking about natural allies that don't see the importance of our vote. And so we really partnered up in a couple different ways. Our strategies first were to partner with the Native Organizers Alliance, the Center for Native American Youth, and also the University of Michigan to conduct the largest survey of Native peoples ever done. We had 6,400 Native peoples that participated from all 50 states and 401 tribes. And we wanted to go in and survey on the impact of COVID What were the most critical and urgent issues facing Native communities, especially as they thought about the election, right? We asked about voting behavior, barriers to voting, all of those kinds of things. And what we found is that actually our people are incredibly engaged and have high voter turnout. We had seen over 70%, I think, turnout based on the survey from the previous election. And seeing that, you know, that the key issues that came up for people were everything from COVID to protecting our elders, to access to quality healthcare, to protecting our women and girls and LGBTQ community from violence. I mean, these were in the environment. So we began to really understand what are maybe some issues that are going to motivate our people to the polls. And from that, we were able to devise sort of a narrative and culture change strategy from that. And we founded the Natives Vote 2020 campaign with the Native Organizers Alliance. And really, it was the power of the air game, as I call it, with the narrative and culture change strategy with Native Organizers Alliance, who had boots on the ground in 9 states. And really bringing those two forces together, you know, we mobilized, we registered thousands of new Native voters. And there were great stories about some voters in their 70s and 80s that were voting for the first time, right, along with young people. But also seeing historic turnout in places like Arizona, Nevada, and Michigan. And, you know, that was really important. But as was our media work to really constantly in the press say, you can't ignore the Native vote. This is an important constituency. Our vote matters. And saying this, you know, to the progressive movement, to candidates, and really elevating that importance. And we were just absolutely, we weren't surprised when we saw the outcome. We knew our people were going to turn out. And I'm so excited because I think for the first time in this country, there was an acknowledgement that the Native vote does matter, especially when we're operating in an environment where razor thin margins can determine the outcome.
Oh, absolutely. I am here to really thank you and everyone for that work, because it really made a big difference in terms of the outcome. And I want to spend the last couple of minutes we have together to just hear about what's the work ahead. What are you thinking about? You know, we now have for the first time, which seems absolutely insane, that we have the first Native American to serve as Interior Secretary. And I know that there was a groundswell of support for her candidacy, and also that it was a push to get her confirmed. So I'm just wondering, you know, what is ahead?
Yeah, definitely. Well, we were really proud to play an organizing role among, you know, so many of our dear colleagues in Indian Country to really support her nomination and confirmation, and tears of joy, right? And what that means for our people. You know, I think for us, as we think about the work ahead, it's really the work we do is driven about how do we build power for our people. And I think we feel incredible momentum coming off of 2020. I mean, despite the fact that it was a horrifying year on so many levels, it was also an odd year in that so many victories in terms of Native representation from, you know, the Washington football team name change or the Cleveland baseball team's name change to, you know, the outcome of the election, the Native vote, but we have 6 new members, Native members of Congress, or 5 now that Secretary Holland has moved over there, but we're hoping there'll be
right.
That will fill her vacancy. And then the success of getting her confirmed. I think Native people are like, yeah. So we're, you know, how do we build power? And there's this energy that we're feeling where we're being seen, and we're seeing, actually 21 is going to be a banner year for Native representation in TV in particular. There's 4 new Native shows, that are kind of slated to be coming out over the next years. So we're really focused on that organizing. And I think, you know, one of the things we're definitely looking at are the midterm elections in 22. And so we're doing a lot of work, you know, continued deep work with, you know, Native Organizers Alliance and Culture Surge as well, to really think about how do we continue to really engage and mobilize Native communities, women, people of color, right? Because it's so important in this moment. It is so desperately important that we continue to organize as we face the onslaught of white supremacy and the forces that are just tearing our country apart. I mean, when it's easier to buy a gun than it is to vote, there's something deeply, deeply wrong in this country. So I think we're very much focused on, again, you know, the power of narrative and culture change work, But it's only to me in its mind, its true power only comes alive when it combines with grassroots organizing. And so really, how do we deepen those bridges with movement groups, right? Where there's this sort of this reciprocity and flow, because I think you really need both to really truly affect change in really significant ways. So as part of that deepening work, we're continuing to do more audience research so that we better can understand the minds of Americans and how we move them on Native issues. But also we're going to be doing our second Indigenous Futures Survey later this year, right, to really build on the first one and deepen those issues with the, you know, kind of midterm elections and beyond in mind. And I think, you know, one of the other big things that we're focused on and we'll be starting to roll out next month is a national vaccine campaign. We're partnered with the Urban Indian Health Institute, and to really ensure that we're educating Native peoples about the importance of getting vaccinated. But we also understand our people don't trust the government. There's a lot of distrust for very good reasons. And so the understanding of the vaccine is one part of that solution. We need to continue to mask up and social distance and these things so that we can really help our communities, protect our communities, and really hopefully get back to a place where we can thrive. So, you know, that continued important work on COVID is also something we're focused on.
Wow. Thank you so much, Christo. And please consider me your ally and supporter in any co-conspiracy work and advocacy. I'm here and would love to continue to partner with you. And thank you so much for all the work that you are doing and for also sharing your personal journey and also the journey with your daughter. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. And so grateful for you and for all co-conspirators. Great things happen when we can co-conspire for a higher good.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for joining me for this conversation. If you want to learn more about our guests, their work and campaigns, and how to get more engaged, go to medium.com/Kiskadee and follow us on social media. We would love to hear from you. Kiskadee is executive produced by Bia Vieira, produced by Wanda Costa of Starlet Productions. Original music composed by Maxine Solomon. Original artwork by Yasmin Hernandez, Wanda Costa, and Nicholas Schultz. Graphic illustrations by Kay Dugan Morrell of Illustrating Progress. A very special thanks to all of our guests and supporters, the Women's Foundation California, the Culture Change Fund, and you.